Hey, everybody. It is Monday, March 4th. We all March 4th here into a new week on the Mo News Podcast. I'm Mo Shwanunu.
And I'm Jill Wagner. This is the place where we bring you just the facts.
And we read all the news and read between the lines so you don't have to. And I know March began on Friday, but like this is the first full week of the month, Jill. A couple things. I'm in Florida for the week. We're actually going to be doing a Mo News Premium meetup for South Floridians. Look out on the premium Instagram account if you want to connect. We'll be doing an event later this week. We're going to be doing these as we travel around. And I've gotten enough feedback from all of you who are like, let us know when you're in town. So I'm in town. We're beginning this tradition, what we hope to be a new tradition, in South Florida this week.
Very cool. I'm sorry I'm going to miss it.
We'll FaceTime you in, Jill.
We'll have to do. Yes, please. I would love it. And pardon my voice. Somehow I woke up Sunday sounding normal and then it all went downhill. And I don't really know what's going on. I'm just going to blame the kids per usual.
That totally makes sense. I totally buy that. We'll try to limit how much you talk here on the pod today, Jill. One more note before we get started, a shout out to the Steiners, who producer Emily Gross met over the weekend. They are loyal listeners to the Mo News Podcast. In fact, I just learned that they gave each other the gift of premium this Valentine's Day. And one of them wrote a poem to the other, and I will read it here. Roses are red, violets are blue. I've got a gift just for us too. Bull and Brand sheets, athletic greens, no, it's something more grand, a Mo News Premium group plan. Because what says I love you more than fact-based news, access to Mo's private Instagram account, and exclusive podcast interviews. Get ready to review the headlines of each day as we sit down for dinner, feasting on our Factor trays.
10 out of 10. I mean,
10 out of 10. Well done, folks.
Mosh, no pressure. I mean, now the premium's got to be worth every penny, which it is.
So our gratitude to Rob and Sarah Steiner, very loyal listeners, clearly based on that rhyming poem. And a reminder, you can all give each other the gift of premium. You don't have to wait till Valentine's Day. It's available over at mo.news/premium. You get weekend news coverage, as well as a whole bunch of other stuff. Talk to the Steiners about it. We'll give you their email address.
Okay, let's get to some news here. Starting with presidential politics, a state of play ahead of Super Tuesday. The Supreme Court set to release a bunch of decisions today with a ruling on whether Trump can appear on the Colorado ballot, a strong possibility. A State of the Union preview. Violence raging in Haiti following a massive jailbreak.
Yeah, we're going to take a closer look on the situation in Haiti, which does not get enough attention. So we'll dive into that today.
To the Middle East, the status update on a potential hostage ceasefire deal as the U.S. airdrops aid into Gaza. Oregon could revive penalties for drug possession. What exactly the change means?
Yeah, remember, they were at the forefront of decriminalizing drugs. And now they're reversing some of those decisions.
A huge California blizzard battering Tahoe and the Sierra, and it's sparking avalanche warnings. To college basketball, Caitlin Clark becomes NCAA basketball's all-time top scorer over the weekend.
Yeah, you might remember she beat the women's record. This weekend, she surpassed the men's record.
Also this weekend, what Rihanna, Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, and Ivanka Trump are all doing together. We're going to take you to an Indian billionaire's family wedding. Plus, Moshe has on this day in history.
Joe, we're going to take you back to a tradition that existed in the early days of the U.S. On this day, March 4th, was the day the White House would host an open house to the public. Literally, anybody could walk around the White House. The president was there. We'll take you to the day it went wrong during the Jackson administration.
Genuinely looking forward to that, Moshe. Okay, let's start with what is a big week in politics, the Super Tuesday primaries tomorrow, and then later this week, Joe Biden's final State of the Union address before the election. We got some new polling this weekend, and it's adding to concerns on the Democrat side about Joe Biden's chances of beating Donald Trump in the fall. According to a new poll by the New York Times and Siena College, widespread concerns about President Biden's age pose a deepening threat to his reelection bid. A majority of voters who voted for Biden the first time in 2020 now say he is too old to lead the country effectively. A striking 61% say they thought he was, quote, just too old to be an effective president. As they consider whether to vote for him again in 2024, 19% of those who did vote for him in 2020 say the 81-year-old president's age is such a problem they feel he is no longer capable of handling the job.
Just to reiterate there, that's 1 out of 5 Biden voters from 4 years ago say that they don't think he can do the job anymore.
73% of all registered voters say he's too old to be effective, despite the fact that Trump is only 3.5 years younger and turning 78 this year. Voters haven't expressed the same anxieties about his age compared to the 61% of Biden voters who think he is too old to be effective. Just 15% of Trump's 2020 voters feel the same way about him. Staying with how they're doing among previous voters, another warning sign for Joe Biden. Right now, Donald Trump winning 97% of those who say they voted for him 4 years ago. And virtually none of his past supporters say that they're going to cast a ballot for Joe Biden. In contrast, Biden is winning only 83% of his 2020 voters, with 10% saying they now back Trump.
Yeah, so a warning sign as far as their previous voters, they're not insignificant. And it does come as when you look at the 2020 election, Biden, despite winning by millions and millions of voters in the popular, when you look at the Electoral College, there are a number of states there where he won, where it was 10,000 votes that made a difference in places like Arizona, Georgia, not that much more in Wisconsin and Michigan. So the fact that you're seeing him lose a bit of his voters from 2020 is causing concern among some in his campaign, among some Democrats. At the same time, you have other folks there who are like, they're going to come around. They're totally going to come around in the fall as we make our case. That wasn't the only poll out over the weekend. CBS had a poll out talking about the number one issue for voters, the economy. And that's another issue here for Biden. According to the poll, voters recall the economy under Trump more fondly than the economy they have now. And a majority feel that Biden's policies will make prices go up, while a majority feel Trump's policies will make prices go down. What that speaks to, what that gets to, is the question that Ronald Reagan made famous in his 84 re-election, which is, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And if you look at this polling, what it shows here is that the majority of Americans say, no, I'm not better off than I was 4 years ago. The question is, how does that translate to their vote? Given the fact that Biden ran as stability, Biden ran as restoring sanity, Biden said, you know, listen, Trump was chaos. I'm going to give you calm for 4 years. Republicans are going to try to turn that on its head. Say, inflation, border chaos, wars in Ukraine, wars in Israel. They're going to play the nostalgia of the first 3 years of Trump pre-COVID and say, the guy promised all this stuff and didn't give it to you.
Moshe, the 4 years ago question is so fascinating, given that 4 years ago, we were in the throes of COVID. The fact that people think that they were better off then than they are now really says something.
I think what they're looking at is the more holistic view, which is like 2017 to February of 2020. And we kind of just like, you know, put an asterisk next to that COVID period. But I mean, to your point, the Biden administration is going to try to remind voters of that. Like, listen, do you remember the craziness of COVID? Do you remember the crazy press conferences? Do you remember the chaos? Just remember the general chaos of those 4 years. But for many voters, they're looking at, you know, what they're seeing now. And they're saying, well, maybe it wasn't so bad back then. I do remember prices were lower and I do remember things were more attainable. And so I think, you know, what you're going to see laid out this week in the State of the Union address when Biden delivers that on Thursday night and just this campaign for the next 9 months is reframing. Trump's going to try to reframe these 4 years versus his 4 years. Biden's going to try to frame these 4 years versus Trump's 4 years. And the question is, whose message is going to resonate better with voters? Now, we are talking about Biden v. Trump. It isn't finalized yet. They are both within the next 3 weeks going to be able to lock up the nomination. If you look at the numbers, a key to that will be what transpires tomorrow, Super Tuesday. 16 states plus American Samoa will be voting. Both men, Biden and Trump on their respective sides, are looking for a clean sweep. That appears to be the case here. Biden faces a little serious competition. Nikki Haley still hasn't beaten Trump in a single state, and it's not looking very good for her tomorrow. Remember Super Tuesday, all those states, basically a third of all delegates are available. 70% of the delegates needed to clinch the nomination mathematically will be available tomorrow for the convention. So right now, it looks like the earliest Trump can lock things up is March 12th, a week from now. And then Biden can lock things down on March 19th. And then in earnest, we can call them the quote unquote presumptive nominee. Is not that it hasn't been pretty obvious for a while now. Speaking of Haley for a second here, she did some interviews over the weekend, including one over on NBC's Meet the Press, where she made some news. She said that she no longer feels bound by a pledge that she made earlier last year to support the party's eventual nominee, Donald Trump. Now, this is a pledge she made to participate in the debates last year. As she says, the RNC now is not the same RNC. Remember, Trump has now put his daughter-in-law and another ally in charge of the Republican National Committee. She says she's not sure whether Trump will follow the Constitution. So she's sort of staking an independent path here and, you know, using whatever leverage she believes she has with her voters and not saying that she's an automatic supporter of Trump, which is a contrast from what we've heard from her for the past few months.
Meanwhile, the Supreme Court has indicated that it will issue rulings today, one of which could be the highly anticipated decision on whether Colorado can kick former President Trump off the primary ballot. The court noted on its website Sunday that rulings are expected today. Trump is currently set to appear on the state primary ballot on Tuesday after a hold was placed on the Colorado Supreme Court ruling that deemed him ineligible because of his efforts to defy the 2020 election results. The U.S. Supreme Court held oral arguments on February 8th on whether Trump can be barred from the ballot because of his role leading up to the January 6th, 2021 attack on the Capitol. Section 3 of the Constitution's 14th Amendment says that people are not eligible to serve in government if they, quote, engaged in insurrection. It appeared, at least from the oral argument, that Trump will win this case.
Yeah, there are a lot of questions there about the interpretation of the 14th Amendment, whether Trump actually committed insurrection as defined by the court, whether they view that an act of Congress would be required to kick someone off the ballot. By the way, we heard from some Coloradans who are like, wait, Trump's still on the ballot here. Yes, because they froze the ruling. So effectively here, the Supreme Court will rule, and then any votes for Trump would have been negated if they rule against this. But indications are that they don't believe that all 50 states will be able to have autonomy to just kick federal candidates off of ballots. But we're going to look out for that case today. So stay tuned on the Instagram account for that. One more thing, as we mentioned, State of the Union address Thursday night, Biden will try to use that to remind Americans what he's accomplished over the course of the past 4 years. Infrastructure spending, bring down inflation, scrapping junk fees, you know, everything from airline tickets to hotel junk fees to Ticketmaster. So there's a bunch of things you can expect to hear laid out. The big complaint among some Democrats is that Biden has not been effective in using the bully pulpit and communicating effectively what he's accomplished. And that's leading to some of the issues and a lot of voters who are like, well, what has he actually done? So you're going to get that Thursday night. I don't know how many people watch that live, but they're going to try to reinforce that on social media, et cetera. And he'll be trying to reinforce his whole message of stability over change in 2024. So you'll get a preview effectively of what they think is his most effective campaign message. And then, Jill, you and I can discuss whether we thought it was effective.
Okay, now to an international crisis unfolding just a two-hour flight from the U.S. in the Caribbean that we wanted to dive into today. We're talking, of course, about the dire situation on the island of Haiti. Haiti's main prison is now nearly empty after multiple armed gangs attacked it Saturday night. About 4,000 inmates fled. It comes amid escalating violence and a desperate plea by the country's prime minister for an international force to help him take back control of the country. The prime minister, Ariel Henry, is currently outside of the country. So gangs now control about 80% of the capital, Port-au-Prince. The criminal gangs are rallying together to show a united front against international aid and authority. Violence has gripped Haiti really for the last 2 years, and it follows the assassination of the Haitian president in July of 2021. So this sounds crazy, but there are actually no elected national leaders in the country. The prime minister who I just mentioned, Ariel Henry, he was appointed after the assassination with the support of international countries. Elections were supposed to take place, but the prime minister said the country wasn't safe enough. Meanwhile, there have been protests across the country calling for him to resign. Haiti lacks a police force or a military to deal with the violence. Gangs control most of the capital and other parts of the country, and they are using sexual assault and other type of violence to terrorize the population. Haiti has long been considered the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere and one of the poorest in the world. Half of the country is eating just one meal a day. That is 5 million people, and about 1.8 million face severe starvation.
Yeah, as we focus on all these crises around the world, this is pretty close to home here. in the U.S. and has probably not gotten the attention it deserves, though expect to hear more about it in the coming days and weeks, especially with the developments over the weekend. The escalating violence, the jailbreak, the gang control all happened. As you mentioned, Jill, the prime minister is outside of the country right now. He happens to be in Kenya, where he's trying to get a deal for an international force led by Kenya to come in and help stabilize Haiti. They signed a deal late last week. Gangs say they're roaming the capital right now, looking for the police chief, looking for politicians, planning to tie them up and abduct them. The UN has been discussing this for more than a year. They approved a force, but of course, that costs money. Who's going to pay for it? The estimate is it could cost between $500 and $600 million for an international force to come in and help Haiti here. The US has pledged $200 million of it. They still need about $300 million additional dollars from the rest of the world. And so you have the prime minister here going around asking for help. The US Secretary of State, by the way, notes that among the very concerning situations on the island, 3 million children right now need immediate aid, the U.S. says, in Haiti. So they struck this deal with Kenya, still up in the air, the size of this force, who makes up this force, when the force arrives, and how exactly they'll engage in war with these street gangs in Haiti. At the same time, we have been seeing a surge of Haitian migrants, among the many migrants coming across the U.S. border, coming from unstable countries, Venezuela, Ecuador, Haiti, among them. So just a reminder here, as you see the situation on the U.S. southern border, that you know this is one of the root causes of why you see some of these migrants coming across. We got some questions on the Instagram account about the Dominican Republic. If you look at the island there, half of it, the western half is Haiti. The eastern half is the Dominican Republic. So the Dominican Republic has been taking in some migrants. They've also been kicking out some illegal migrants from Haiti for the last couple of years. They're actually in the midst of building a wall there on the about 100-mile border that they share with Haiti. They had a blockade on Haiti last year intermittently. So, you know, context there for people who are looking at vacations in the DR and were wondering about the connection between the two. So far, they've been pretty successful in ensuring that violence doesn't spread across the border, but that's one of the reasons that they're trying to bolster the border. And one more note historically here, and you know, this is some context, some notes I got from several of you on the Instagram account as we focused on this. Haiti was actually one of the richest countries in this entire region in the 1700s when it was a French colony. They fought a war to remove French colonial powers in the late 1700s, but then were forced to pay the modern equivalent of $20 billion in reparations to France. That didn't help. Fast forward to the 20th century. The U.S. actually invaded and occupied Haiti for 20 years, between 1915 and 1935. The U.S. reimposed segregation in Haiti, created forced labor in Haiti, helped remove and approve the assassinations of multiple leaders in Haiti during the time period. Finally, FDR gets out, but none of that helped. So there's been a lot of instability, dictatorships. The U.S. and the U.N. were involved in the 90s in trying to stabilize the country. But it's been a tough going for a while now. And then you had the 2010 earthquake where several hundred thousand people died. And they've had a lot of trouble recovering from that. I just wanted to bring some of the historical context in there because these things don't happen in a bubble. And there's a reason why Haiti is in the situation it is in.
It's so interesting, Moshe, because I had no idea that the U.S. actually controlled Haiti for 20 years in the 20th century.
Yeah, we could probably do a whole separate series on this podcast, Jill, on the U.S. role in Central and South America and the Caribbean.
I thought you were going to say places we've messed up.
Yeah, we could certainly that. I mean, by the way, we're not alone, but we certainly had a role in that. We've done both good and we've also done some harm, significant harm across the world with short-term objectives, but they've had a long-term impact. We could do a whole separate conversation about Cuba in the early 20th century and the role the U.S. played there. And that could go one by one. We could talk about Chile. We could talk about Argentina. We could talk about Nicaragua, a variety of countries. But if there's interest in that, let us know, folks. And you know, maybe we'll prepare a little historical series for you. All right, we have a lot more news to get to, including today's speed read. But first, I want to thank our big sponsor this week, Factor Meals. We're definitely pressed for time in our house, and I still want to eat healthy, nutritious meals. And that's why I'm so excited about Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal delivery service. So the thing about Factor is you can pick your meals. They get delivered to your door. You put them in the fridge, and typically you can heat them up in a couple minutes, and they're ready to go. And they're not just your, you know, parents' frozen meals from the grocery store. They are chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I've been loving them lately. I take them to work with me to the Mo News headquarters, and they often serve as my lunch. You get to skip, you know, preparing meals or the more expensive, you know, delivery or picking up a sandwich around the corner. And so there's the convenience factor, the cost factor, but also the nutritional factor. You get the nutritional quality you need. There's 35 plus weekly meals to choose from. It's flexible. You get as many meals as you want, as few meals as you want. And you can also pause and reschedule deliveries at any time. So check them out. Factormeals.com/MoNews50. Again, that is Factor, F-A-C-T-O-R, meals.com, factormeals.com/MoNews50 for 50% off. Again, that is 50% off. I definitely think it's worth a try. All right, Jill, I think we're ready for the speed read. I saw you just got a cup of tea.
I did. It's actually throat coat tea, so hopefully it'll help.
It's good stuff.
From ABC News, Vice President Kamala Harris will meet with Israeli War Cabinet member Benny Gantz at the White House today. It is part of an ongoing effort to engage with a wide range of Israeli officials on the war in Gaza. During the meeting, Harris is expected to reiterate Israel's right to defend itself in the face of threats by Hamas and the urgency of securing a hostage deal. Biden is reportedly pushing very hard for a temporary ceasefire deal that's being discussed. Biden called the Emir of Qatar and the president of Egypt late last week, and his message was direct: get me a deal. Israel has said yes to a 6-week ceasefire deal, but at this point, Hamas has not agreed to it. So as of right now, the terms are that Israel would release about 400 Palestinian prisoners, including 15 convicted of murdering Israelis. And in exchange, Hamas would free about 40 of the 130-plus Israeli hostages that are still being held in Gaza, including women, female soldiers, men over 50, and men who are in serious medical condition.
Yeah, so it'd be about 10 Palestinian prisoners for every one Israeli hostage, and that would still leave behind about 90 or so Israeli hostages, both living or the remains of which. Remember, there's a couple dozen Israeli hostages who Israel believes are dead, but their bodies are still being held by Hamas. One of the additional issues right now in these negotiations is that Hamas has not presented the Israelis with a list of the hostages who are still alive. The Israelis have demanded that. Hamas is not willing to give them that list, saying, we're not ready to tell you who's alive yet. This framework, by the way, again, would be part of a 6-week pause in the fighting in Gaza. Part of the deal also would be more aid into northern Gaza and the return of Palestinian citizens into some of the areas where you have seen battle continue to take place over the last few months. Speaking of aid to Gazans, the dire humanitarian situation in the Strip, over the weekend, you may have seen the pictures, the video of U.S. airdrops, literally airdropping aid into Gaza. 3 U.S. Air Force cargo planes dropped 38,000 ready-to-eat meals in a joint operation with the Jordanian Air Force. More are planned. So you had 66 pallets of aid dropped over Gaza. They chose what they believe were safe areas where people are sheltering and in need, not in coordination with Hamas. The intention here is to sustain those airdrops. The U.S. is also looking to create a maritime corridor, a sea-based corridor, to bring aid in via the sea. Aid is still getting into Gaza via the ground, but not nearly enough for the population there, given the dire circumstances they're in. You have the Israelis also limiting aid convoys into active battle zones, and that's where people live and still need aid, but they're not getting it, hence the airdrops. Also, some of the trucks that are going in are getting taken over by criminal gangs, by Hamas. And so you have these very desperate scenes that you saw play out, like last Thursday. We told you about it on the podcast last week, where more than 100 Palestinians were killed when a stampede took place, and also several approached Israeli troops and were shot. And we're still in a situation where there's 2 stories told of what took place there last Thursday. Hamas and Palestinian locals saying that the Israelis were responsible for the majority of the deaths there in that aid convoy. The Israelis saying that the vast majority of Palestinians were killed in a separate stampede in a separate part of the area, not related to the incident and the exchange of fire with the Palestinians. The bottom line here, though, is the U.S. goal, as you laid out, is to get a pause in fighting yesterday. Biden is desperate for this. Kamala Harris is desperate for this. Part of the reason is also domestic politics. They're seeing more and more Democrats who are angry with the administration for allowing the war to continue, for the continued support of Israel. And so they're looking for a temporary ceasefire, which they hope will eventually be a permanent ceasefire to help deal with both the situation on the ground in Gaza, but also help them with the political situation on the ground here in the U.S.
All right, from the Associated Press, Oregon is poised to step back from its first-in-the-nation drug decriminalization law with a new measure approved by the state Senate that would basically reinstate criminal penalties for possessing even small amounts of some drugs. So the law originally took effect in 2021, and it decriminalized possession and personal use of all drugs, including small amounts of heroin, methamphetamine, LSD, oxycodone, and others. Supporters of revising the statute say it's needed to address the state's overdose crisis. Opponents say it reverts to an approach that hasn't been beneficial and could violate civil rights. So if signed, which the governor is expected to do, it would restore penalties for possessing some of those drugs that I just mentioned. Possession of marijuana, which has been legalized for medical and recreational use, would not be affected.
Yes, this all comes as Oregon is experiencing one of the largest spikes in drug overdose deaths in the country. The state has the second highest rate of substance use disorder in the nation and also ranks 50th for treatment access. And that was a huge issue here in terms of legalization or decriminalization, I should say, was ensuring that people could get treatment. And that continues to be an issue in the state. So that's prompted a lot of criticism, a lot of pressure internally. There's also a ballot campaign to further weaken the statute underway. Now, some researchers who've been studying all of this have said that it's too early to determine whether the decriminalization has contributed to this increase in overdoses. But observers here say that's pretty obvious. We don't need further research on that. But at the same time, Jill, you mentioned the opponents. They say that recriminalization reverts to a failed, decades-old approach of arresting people for possessing even small amounts of drugs, and they worry that it'll disproportionately impact people affected by drug addiction and focuses too much on punitive measures and not enough on treatment. So it appears that there's this pendulum swing happening in Oregon, and the concern is that they're going to swing too far to what existed before. But, you know, honestly, Jill, you know, we've heard from some people in the Mo News community who talk about these situations in areas of Portland where it's zombie land. You know, literally these people are high and, you know, you have certain areas of the city that you avoid now due to the decriminalization and the fact that people can do this and they're not getting the treatment that they need, which was part and parcel of the initial goal here. So this is a story we'll continue to follow because remember, Oregon was going to serve as an example to other cities and others have hit the pause button on decriminalization due to what's been unfolding there.
From the LA Times, the most powerful California blizzard of the season pounded the Sierra Nevada with gusts of up to 190 miles per hour.
Hurricane strength winds from those blizzards up there in the high mountains.
Several feet of heavy snow also stranded hundreds of vehicles on Sunday, forcing the closure of key roads to the Lake Tahoe and Mammoth Mountain areas. A rare blizzard warning was extended through today for the Lake Tahoe area, and an additional foot and a half could fall where the abandoned vehicles are at Donner Pass.
Jill, incidentally, Donner Pass is named after a group of Americans who were traveling through there, the Donner Party, two brothers in 1846, got stuck there. A bunch of people died, and then they had to resort to cannibalism to survive.
Oh my God.
Anyway, thankfully, no cannibalism based on what we know or is necessary with the blizzard, but it just struck me that, you know, you had a bunch of cars, people stuck at Donner Pass and the dark history of that area.
Who was the person who was like, let's name this for the Donners. Let's name this Donner Pass.
That's what it was known for. Right? You know, if you go around America or around the world, there's a lot of places named for people and events. And you look into the history of those events and you're like, oh, that's pretty dark. But the name sticks, Jill. Thankfully, the majority of people listened to meteorologists, listened to officials, did not try to venture out during this record blizzard up there. I did hear from some people, some locals who are like, I can't believe people tried to drive through this. Like, we know better up here. Like, we've gotten storms here with several feet. But sadly, you did see those pictures of all those trucks stuck there. And now the emergency workers are trying to get those vehicles removed one by one. Now, this storm, by the way, the highest elevations could dump 12 feet of snow. And look for the numbers in the coming days here, but it could result in one of the 10 snowiest days in California history for this area. Some areas got 2 to 4 feet of snow. Some got up to 6 feet of snow. Some got up to 10 feet of snow. So pretty treacherous right now. Then there'll be a break. And then more blizzard conditions are expected later this week. So be on the lookout if you're traveling or need to go anywhere near that area.
All right, from NBC Sports, 2 weeks after she broke the record for women, Caitlin Clark has become the overall top scorer in college basketball history, period. The Iowa Hawkeyes star went into Sunday's game against the Ohio State Buckeyes, needing 18 points to break Pistol Pete Maravich's record of 3,667 career points. That record has stood for more than 50 years. And with a second quarter free throw, she became the top scoring player, man or woman, in NCAA basketball history. And by the end of the game, she had scored 35 points.
Yeah, so she now has the NCAA scoring record of 3,685 points overall, everybody. And it comes during her final regular season game as a college athlete. And what's wild here, Jill, is she has another year of eligibility. Because of that COVID year, she could play a fifth year, but she has chosen instead to enter the WNBA draft after this fourth season. So we'll see how things go for her through March Madness as she continues to add points to that total. And then she will go pro.
Now, this weekend's Iowa-Ohio State matchup was the most expensive women's basketball game ever. Tickets averaged more than $550.
Wow. Jill, people are also very excited about, with that in mind, what she will bring to the WNBA and the excitement that she'll bring to professional women's basketball, just given how amazing a player she is.
Yeah, she's fun to watch. My husband said to me on Sunday, he's like, I've watched more women's college basketball than I've watched men's college basketball this season. Okay, and from the Wall Street Journal, what do Mark Zuckerberg, Ivanka Trump, Bob Iger, Bill Gates, and Rihanna have in common?
A lot of money, Jill. That's all. That's my answer.
Well, that is true, Moshe. But they were also all in India this weekend to attend the lavish pre-wedding festivities of Anant Ambani, who is the youngest son of Asia's richest billionaire, Mukesh Ambani, who is the chairman of the energy giant Reliance Industries. So Indian families, regardless of their wealth, are known to splurge on weddings that span multiple days. But when India's richest families host a wedding, the wedding budget could run into the tens of millions of dollars. Now, to put this into perspective here, Mukesh Ambani's net worth is estimated at about $100 billion, so a drop in the bucket here. His 28-year-old son, Anant, is marrying 29-year-old Radhika Merchant. She is also the child of a business tycoon. Over the weekend, the normally quiet coastal town of Jamnagar hosted about 1,000 VIP guests from around the world.
All right, so check this out. The guests were offered chartered flight services from Mumbai and Delhi, complimentary hairstylists, makeup artists, sari drapers. They were hospitality desks in the field to help with logistics for all these people as they came in. There were themed events throughout the weekend. There was a formal dinner on Friday and then a private concert from Rihanna. It's actually her first concert in India and happens to be a private show that she did. But wait for it. This is not even the wedding. This is the pre-wedding party. The actual wedding is in July. So all these people came in for pre-wedding festivities. So expect something even bigger. Ambani has several children. For his older daughter, back in 2018, Beyonce performed at that wedding. So the sister had Beyonce. The younger brother got Rihanna at his pre-wedding festivities. Remains to be seen what we see at the wedding in July. And it comes as this younger Ambani generation has taken on more prominent roles in the business of Reliance. They are not just doing oil and gas and energy anymore. They're doing telecom, internet, e-commerce. I mean, the Ambanis are huge. At certain points have been in the top five richest in the world. In fact, the dad here had huge legal issues with his brother when they inherited the business from their fathers. So I guess the grandfather of whose wedding it is, he gave it to the sons. The sons sued each other. Eventually, the businesses were split. They're each worth about $100 billion now. But now the third generation is getting involved. And I should note, the reason Bob Iger was there is because Disney just did a huge tie-up with Reliance. So you are seeing a lot of their connections, which is why you see the Zuckerbergs of the world also coming to this.
The Zuckerbergs of the world. There's not that many Zuckerbergs of the world, right?
Well, Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, but you know, like billionaires worth nine figures, Jill, are coming to the Ambani pre-wedding festivities.
So some people had pointed out that Reliance actually bought the rights to Sephora in India. Mm. So at least on Instagram, some people were wondering if perhaps that's why Rihanna, besides for the millions of dollars that they probably paid her, agreed to perform because she also, of course, has her Fenty beauty line.
Right. We'll have to ask Rihanna next time we have her on the pod. All right, let's conclude here with On This Day in History. We begin in 1829. Jill, March 4th, actually, for the better part of American history, was Inauguration Day. That wasn't changed till the 20th century when January 20th became Inauguration Day. So many of our presidents here in the U.S. were inaugurated on this day. And there was a tradition early on during the first few presidencies to hold an open house on Inauguration Day. Literally open house, like any American can come by the White House and hang out. Thomas Jefferson started the tradition, but then things sort of went awry. On this day in 1829, Andrew Jackson was inaugurated, had his open house, and it turned into a mob scene. 20,000 people. It was a rainy day in D.C., muddy shoes on White House furniture, rummaging through the rooms, looking for the president, breaking dishes. They say that the White House stunk for months afterwards to try to get people out of the White House. They had servants outside promising whiskey and juice on the White House lawn saying, get out of the house. We're going to serve you liquor outside now. That was part of the way to get people out.
I think this is my favorite On This Day ever.
So this is On This Day. This is March 4th, 1829. Chaos at the White House open house. Needless to say, they did keep it around even after the Jackson fiasco of 1829 for a number of years. Finally, Grover Cleveland in 1885 says, we can't do this anymore. We now have had several assassination attempts in history, several assassinations. This ain't safe. So he said, you know what would be a great tradition on Inauguration Day? Let's set up a grandstand and have a parade after I give an inaugural address. And that has, of course, become the modern tradition is you have the inauguration, then the parade to the White House with the president watching the parade from the White House in lieu of the open house, people bringing in their muddy boots, standing on furniture and breaking plates.
When you first started explaining it, my initial thought was, didn't it get crowded? And I guess the answer is yes. And that's the least of it.
It was like 100 years before air conditioning, Jill. It's just, it wasn't good. It wasn't good. All right, we're going to stay in the 19th century here for one more item. On this day in 1837, Chicago was incorporated as a city, had a population of about 4,000 at the time, slightly bigger these days. Jill, fun fact, as a Chicagoan born and raised, many people don't know this. What does Chicago mean? What does Chicago stand for, the original name?
I don't even want to guess. I feel like it's going to be embarrassing. Just tell us.
Here's your fun fact. Chicago is a derivative of a native word for that area. Smelly onion. There were natural onions that grew there. And the native tribes that lived there called it Chicaca, the smelly onion that grew there. And so that's Chicago. So Chicago means, folks, smelly onion.
Moshe, I don't know what you have coming up, but this is definitely just so far my favorite on this day.
Jill, we're trying to start Monday strong here. We're trying to start March 4th strong. Fast forward, as I mentioned, it was Inauguration Day, March 4th for many years. On this day in 1933, FDR was inaugurated. This was the day he told the American people, there is nothing to fear but fear itself in his inaugural address there. Of course, FDR would go on to be elected three more times, notably on this day in 1933 for his first term, he swore in the first woman into the cabinet. That was Frances Perkins, and she was the Secretary of Labor. And we end here with a bit of pop culture. On this day in 1950, Cinderella opens in theaters. Disney Cinderella, 74 years ago today.
Given that your daughter is 100% too young to have a watch that, I'm very impressed that you knew the Cinderella. Like, that's not a mainstream reference, I don't think.
Jill, I watched a lot of Disney growing up, and some of it just, it sticks with you. It sticks with you. I probably haven't watched it since the late 80s, early 90s. One of my favorite ABBA songs came out on this day. Waterloo. 50 years ago today, Waterloo.
Great song.
And one of those iconic TV shows, cable shows of the early 2000s, the early aughts, Pimp My Ride, premiered today, 20 years ago on MTV, featuring Exhibit. Pimping people's rides. Jill?
Moshe, you finished strong. I will say, I think this is my favorite on this day.
We're the only podcast that'll give you Andrew Jackson's inaugural open house and Exhibit premiering Pimp My Ride.
We've got range, people. All right. We do want to thank you for listening to the Mo News podcast. If you like what you hear, share this with your friends. It will help us grow. Follow us and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Review us in the App Store. And Moshe, if you're feeling like it, write a poem about us. Share the love with Premium.
Thanks to the Steiners. again, we're giving you a shout out at the end of the podcast again. You guys are great. We appreciate all of our loyal Mo News listeners. Ran into a number of you over the weekend here in South Florida. And again, join Premium for our Premium meetups. First one will be in Miami this Friday.
I hope it goes better than Andrew Jackson's open house, Mosh.
Jill, if we can get 20,000 people to a Mo News Premium event, I'll call it a success, even if it ends in chaos.
And smelly and mud.
Smelly, muddy, and being like, please come outside. I'll serve you whiskey to get you outside of my home.
All right, everyone, have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Mo News Podcast.